For more episodes just like this one on a weekly basis, subscribe to RLRCPSolvers.com. You will not regret it.
Is it Reza loves Robbie or Robbie loves Reza? It's the best palindrome, you will be so impressed. Oh, it's the mathematician and the magician laying out the art of deduction. It's RLR.
Welcome back, clinical problem solvers from DC and San Francisco.
I think San Francisco has worse weather than DC right now, Prof. Rez, which is the ultimate irony. Although, how what does Washington look like right now?
Well, dude, okay, so I walked Frankie, my brother's dog, this morning, and it was 27 degrees.
Oh my gosh.
Okay. Now it's like 45, so it's like heated up a bit. And my dad and I played golf yesterday, and it was like 40 and windy. Dude, and like my skin is so sensitive, my hand is already cracking, you know, like
those. Oh man, let me ask you this: really bad cold but no rain or snow versus not so cold but very rainy?
I would all day every day take a rain.
Yeah
man, I can't, like, not that I can't, I lived in Pittsburgh, that's where I grew up,
yeah,
but yeah, like my skin just doesn't
I
sit
see.
well. I have to put some Aquaphor and stuff. I should consult Gurpreet Dhaliwal to tell me how to deal with dry skin and cracked skin. I remember once we were in clinic, and then my colleague Rachel, who now is at the Stanford, I think Palo Alto VA, was like, "Reza, I feel so silly." I was like, "Why?" She's like, "I just presented a case to Gurpreet, and I said my patient has a hangnail. What do you recommend for the hangnail?"
I'm sure he had some profound advice.
Yeah, he's like, take a nail clipper and just clip it off.
Prof. Rez, you're going to need your fundamental skills for this case as well, which is just so cool. I think this is right up your alley. So this is a story of a 65-year-old woman who comes in and reports 3 days of fatigue and malaise and not feeling well. And I'll just stop there to see what your initial reflections are.
First of all, it's rare that we have a woman at the VA.
I know, so right?
That's my first read. Isn't it interesting? Like, if you had presented this to our mentor, LT, that's the first thing he would say.
100%.
We're becoming old, man. We're not the young.
Not at all.
Boys we used to be. And huge shout out to all our fans. Happy holidays to each and every one of you. Just, I've been getting a lot of text messages because I keep sharing the number online. And it just touches my heart when I get texts from our fans.
Dude, this moment illustrates so much about our personalities. You're this loving, caring guy who has been preparing to thank our fans long ago, but I rudely interrupted and just pushed you right into the case. But no, you will not be outdone. You will still thank them.
And then regarding the case, you know, I think this is what really jumps out that I'll be tracking.
Yeah.
The fatigue, the not feeling well, that's not too helpful because it doesn't really narrow the DDX. It doesn't even narrow the problem frame. Like, I don't even know what the problem is, but there's one thing that does narrow the frame, and that's the duration. You said 3 days. So right away, my mind is like, I'm dealing with likely an acute process and less likely a subacute or chronic process that's just coming to the surface clinically where the patient is recognizing and coming to clinical attention. So right now, the thing that I'm putting into the problem representation is just 3 days acute onset and middle age. I'm saying middle age because, Robbie, I'm 40 now. If we consider 40 middle age, we're in trouble. And no, Matt didn't bleep out the F word. I bleeped it out myself because it's the holiday season. It's Christmas time. I won't say more because I'll get in trouble. Let's go.
Good idea. Okay, for our friends. So this is how it authentically evolved. Okay, so I was actually a decently amount busy. And so I walked in. I said, "Hi, Dr. Robbie, nice to meet you." Said, "Yeah, I'm just fatigued." I looked over the vital signs and I see that her heart rate is 110 and her blood pressure is 165 over 75. And she's a little restless and fidgety and a little tremulous. And I'm curious what those observations do for you.
All right. So this is like our holiday episode. So I'm going to be a little silly here. But you know what the reflex I had here, Rob? And this poor guy has work in like 20s. He's probably like, shut the F up and just solve the case. Where were we? Where were we, Robbie, in the South where it was the word tremulous or tremor? And we didn't even mention thyrotoxicosis.
Oh, yes.
Where was that? Nashville?
That was in Nashville, exactly. Yeah. How could I forget? How could you forget?
Man, we for and then fast forwarded 5 years, and then Robbie, not Robbie, Robbie with the B, presents a case. And once again, I missed it. Charmin and I missed it. Robbie wasn't part of that co-discussion, but this diagnosis of thyroid toxicosis has evaded me so many times. But here's my honest reflection and observation. Whenever I see a fast heart rate and a high blood pressure because of you, I think about the sympathetic system being overactive. And oftentimes, what this means in the patients I see is because they're in pain or discomfort where you have a sympathetic surge. And probably that's going to be the most common cause. I would say the second most common cause of this sympathetic surge is going to be someone that's like early sepsis before it has, made the cardiovascular system fragile and you have ensuing hypotension. Probably the third most common cause is that you have an agent that you're withdrawing from, like someone drinks alcohol, takes benzos, is on a medication, you take it off, and all of a sudden you get the sympathetic surge. I say this because it's really important. This will bring, and when you said tremulous and restless, it makes me think of, excess thyroid or an excess substance. So I'd be really interested in this patient's like urine tox. I'd be really interested in this patient's TSH. And then I have to say one more thing, because I'm really thinking about Gurpreet Dhaliwal right now and common things being common. I'm much more okay with someone just having hypertension at baseline. And the problem we're just solving here is tachycardia, that the hypertension is just where they live. And really the question becomes what's driving the tachycardia. So all that is to say, a quick physical exam, just focused on the hearts, the lung, looking for any kind of sweating that may also further support the sympathetic excess. And then the labs to see if there's any other signs of increased catecholamine release, like a hypokalemia, an elevated lactate, et cetera.
Now, you asked me who shall receive on two fronts. The first is TSH is normal, but as it turns out in our conversation and looking at her chart, she has severe alcohol use disorder and has withdrawn from alcohol many times. She's been like kind of trying to stop and quit, but is here because of this fatigue. There's no abdominal pain, just a little bit of nausea, but no vomiting. And she's been able to keep up and drink and hydrate. So here are her labs. We're going to focus, like essentially the cases really becomes about these labs. So I'm going to give you the exact numbers, okay? Which is unusual for me because you'll know why. The sodium is 139. The potassium is 2.9. The chloride is 114. The bicarb is 14. The anion gap is 11. The glucose is 86, the BUN is 18, and the creatinine is 0.9. I'll stop there, see what you think.
That's really helpful, and thank you for giving us the anion gap. I'll go in order. First, we have the hypokalemia, and that potassium is 2.9. And I think when the potassium is less than 3, it really makes me want to figure out what's driving the hypokalemia. But also, it makes me want to get an electrocardiogram. You are within that sort of lab margin of error. Maybe the next one's 3.1, who knows? But I want to see, are we dealing with any kind of disturbances that hypokalemia might have on the electrical circuit of the heart? In general, hypokalemia, you shouldn't really look at it in a vacuum, but I think for our listeners and even for myself, let's just look at it in a vacuum, meaning isolated without any of the other electrolyte abnormalities. It's really easy to solve the problem of an electrolyte disturbance and to really simplify it. One is you don't have enough dietary intake of that electrolyte, but that's almost never the case. And you should never lead your framework based on that. It almost becomes the exercise of is there gastrointestinal loss? Or is there renal loss? And less commonly, is there transcellular shift? So, in order, GI, renal, transcellular shift, and less likely in someone who may have anorexia nervosa, Is there decreased intake? By the way, I don't even know what nervosa stands for, but for those who have my number, don't text me because I can just look it up on GPT. And it's John Sperati, a nephrologist that we have to say names now that we're older, and these names mean nothing to
You're
anyone.
name dropping a lot today, Prof.
These names mean nothing to anyone except the person who has the name. There's probably a term for that. But John Sperati would say, look, most of these electrolyte derangements, especially potassium and sodium, you can diagnose just based on the history alone. And so when I would see that, Kay, I would ask the patient, and maybe you can answer this in real time, Robbie, have you had any vomiting or diarrhea?
No.
Okay, that's really helpful. And by the way, I know I said I wouldn't bring in the other electrolytes, but we do know that the bicarb is on the lower end, 14, and there is no anion gap. And this is assuming that the patient has like a normal albumin and the gap we calculated is based on a normal albumin. I say that because if you, and I'll give you a quick exercise for the audience. Would you expect hypokalemia with a low bicarb in someone who's vomiting or in someone who is having diarrhea? And the answer to that is when you vomit, it's not that you're so much losing acid. You are losing a lot of, you are losing acid, but that's not what's driving the rise in bicarb. It's re really accessing the, activating the renin-angiotensin aldosterone system where you're secreting a bunch of hydrogen and then the bicarb rises. And when you have diarrhea, you end up losing a lot of that bicarb and you develop this normal gap metabolic acidosis. Is this patient on any diuretic therapy, Robbie?
No.
No. And those are the two most common causes. They're either vomiting, they're having diarrhea, or they're on diuretic. And the diuretic therapy is interesting too, because that too contracts you and activates renin-angiotensin aldosterone system. You secrete the hydrogen ion, your bicarb. So you may have like a metabolic alkalosis, both with vomiting and with diuretic use. When you have diarrhea, it's more metabolic acidosis because you're losing all that bicarb. Okay. So this is actually really interesting. So now I'm like, wait a minute. K2.9, maybe with alcohol use disorder, we know a lot of the electrolytes are deranged. A lot of patients have hypokalemia, hypophosphatemia, hypomagnesemia. And what I would honestly do, and I'm just going to ask you this right now, I would look at her chart and look at prior measurements. Do we have a K in recent memory?
Yeah, her K and mag have been low for a long time. But her bicarb has never been low. This is the first time her bicarb is low.
That's really, really helpful. And the reason I say that's helpful is because we know patients who use alcohol, there's a great NAJM article and they tell you the exact but it's multiple mechanisms from decreased intake to alcohol's inhibition of vasopressin acting as a diuretic and you losing a lot of electrolytes in the urine. And even through some transcellular shifts, for example, they don't eat much, their glucose is low, then they take a big meal, they get an insulin spike, and you get stuff shifted into the cell. So I think alcohol through from the gastrointestinal, the renal, and the cellular level can affect electrolytes. And that's why you got to be cautious and monitor and give thiamine, like Uncle Bob would say in such patients. Now, potassium and magnesium have a very special relationship. And we all know this from medical school or from nursing school or whatever school you've gone to, that in order to replenish potassium, you got to replenish the magnesium. So sometimes the issue isn't actually the potassium, but it's the magnesium. And the way you can tell which one to focus on is the severity of the abnormality. You see, magnesium, when it's low, it allows the insertion of these channels called ROMK in the distal nephron. And when ROMK is inserted, just think potassium is entering the channel, getting into the nephron, and getting peed out. So when someone's magnesium is high, the ROMK channels are inhibited. So you're not losing a lot of potassium from the urine. So really, quite frankly, I'd want to know from you, Robbie, is what's the magnesium level of the patient?
Yeah. So, Profrez, I when I got these labs, I added on two things. One
Yes.
is the magnesium level, and then I obtained another test to help clarify the bicarb level. What would you want to know
Yes. Oh my gosh.
about the
Thank you so
bicarb? I'll
much.
give you
So
both. Yeah.
this was actually taught to me by Uncle Bob, and it's such a beautiful point. When you're looking at a BMP and you get this test, there's only one acid-base disturbance, you can definitively diagnose. And that's the anion gap acidosis. And you might say, wait, why is that? It's because the body never compensates for any alkalosis by creating an anion gap acidosis, which can be done by ketones, renal insufficiency, lactate, or an exogenous substance. That's the only one you can tell. So when you tell me the bicarb is 14, it could be the case that this patient is compensating for a respiratory alkalosis by bringing the bicarb low. So which usually, honestly, if you think about it, is usually not the case. It'd be rare instances where someone is breathing, that fast to develop a respiratory alkalosis. So you need a BBG to be able to confidently diagnose the various acid-base disturbances. So I would love it. You don't need an ABG, just a BBG to see what the pH is and what the PCO2 is. And in this case, what I'm gonna guess, because I know respiratory alkalosis is less common, though Robbie did say that the patient is tremulous. So I don't know if they're anxious and they're breathing fast and could they have it's possible. But more likely than not, when you have a scenario where the bicarb is low, you actually are going to have a PCO2 that's low trying to compensate for the low bicarb, which is going to likely be, in most cases, the primary disturbance.
Beautiful, beautiful. So, Prof, when you work in the ER, you see patients like this all the time. You get dulled to seeing this. And what I expected to see was a low potassium and a low magnesium in this patient, as has happened in the past. And that's exactly what happened. Her magnesium came back at 0.9. And then with repleting her magnesium, her potassium resolved, and this was par for the course. What wasn't par for the course is whenever I see an acidosis in a patient like this, I usually see an impressive anion gap. And so what I did was I got a VBG, and the VBG showed an uncompensated, I'll just tell you the numbers. The pH was seven, on the VBG, the pH was 7.29. And I forget what her PCO2 is, but it was perfectly appropriate respiratory compensation. But I was so doubtful about the fact that she had a non-GAP acidosis. It was so weird that I resent the exact same BNP, both to recheck the K and the mag after repletion, but also to see like, what's going on here. And she continued to have a non-GAP acidosis. And confirmed to be a true non-GAP acidosis with a normal albumin. So the problem that I was thinking about is interesting. Okay, so the K and the mag, as par for the course, as is common, hypomag causing hypo-K and alcohol use disorder. But now she has a verified on repeat assessment and VBG proven non-GAP metabolic acidosis. Mic to you, my friend. What do you think?
This is so interesting. And I mean, again, shout out to Uncle Bob because I was always so intimidated by this specific space on how to approach it. And he helped us create a schema, which I won't access right now, but I will after this episode because I'm sure the answer is on that schema. And the first thing he said is like, hey, you want to make sure to not call this a non-GAP acidosis, but rather a normal GAP acidosis. So I was just gonna say that. Bro, jab, jab, jab. But the mic is mine. He'll
Oh, I
jab.
love this. So many people except me today, Prophet.
And
Okay, all right.
then Joel Toff, the kidney whisperer, when you're in this space, you would be interested in the urine anion gap because the question becomes when you have a normal GAP acidosis, it really boils down to two possible buckets. Is this a GI issue or is this a renal issue? There is one more bucket, but that's not the case here. And that's just, imagine this. You're giving someone a substance through the IV, like normal saline, and you are creating an acidosis in that individual. So if you give something through the IV, you can precipitate this exact state where there is no gap because you're giving chloride and they develop this state. But usually, if they're coming to the ED, you're not giving them an exogenous substance. So it becomes as if the GI or the renal. And I will say this, in this case, there's two things I want to say, Robbie. One is the GI is usually obvious because the patient's either having diarrhea or has a prior history, which I don't think you've withheld from us, where they may have some kind of prior abdominal surgery leading to some kind of fistulas and connections that can also give this state. Another easy way to approach this is by calculating the urine anion gap. And the way that Joel Topf said it is that when you calculate the urine anion gap, if it's due to a GI problem, it's negative, gut, GUT, negative. But if it's from the renal, it's positive. That way you can work backwards and understand the physiology, but it's not a problem you'll see that often. So the focus really becomes, is this a renal cause of normal GAP, metabolic acidosis? And the two things I wanted to say is this. I feel sorry for our patients who drink alcohol or use any other substances or have psychiatric, because we often just blame that substance on their problem. Like I had a patient that was taking methamphetamine, and for 5 years, they said the pulmonary hypertension was due to the methamphetamine. But when I examine the hands, when I look at the oral aperture, this patient has, yeah, they did use methamphetamine, but they also had systemic sclerosis and had pulmonary hypertension secondary to that. But then the other thing that we have to be open to is that can alcohol cause any rare consequences where it manifests like this? I think that's something I would look up, but what makes that less likely is you told me, Reza, on all the prior labs, the bicarb was normal. So now I know it's not an alcohol-related issue. So if you look into the renal, so I would get a urine anion gap, but I would just focus on the renal cause. And most of us know the most common cause of normal GAP acidosis, and that's someone who has advanced kidney disease, and they are unable to react to aldosterone. And remember, if aldosterone is secreting hydrogen in the distal nephron, if you can't respond to the aldosterone, the hydrogen will stay back and you'll develop exactly this, a normal GAP acidosis. But there are other causes, and this is where I think it's interesting. If we don't blame the hypokalemia on the alcohol, could this be a renal tubular acidosis? And Robbie already told us that the creatinine is 0.9, and that's not elevated because it's hard to diagnose an RTA when someone has kidney disease. Because we just said if the kidney's not working properly, you might not be able to do homeostasis with hydrogen, and you might develop an acidosis just based on that. Kidney disease is fascinating because you can have both anion gap and normal gap acidosis. Anion gap from the phosphates and sulfates, but normal gap from its inability to respond to aldosterone, I'm thinking. So, Robbie,
This is
let me ask you, did
amazing,
you
by
guys
the
do
way.
a urine anion gap or
I
no?
mean, this is amazing. This is the beauty of the presenter. I get to steer the ship, my man. You've been
Feel it.
in your last few cases, you've been like, Robbie, stop talking. The patient is about to die from the code. I remember that feeling of like, Profrise is steering me, and I'm so excited to steer you today with my hand.
Steer me, steer
No, you're crushing it, by the way. Just so there's no doubt. It's amazing to you amazing to me whenever I present physiology cases to you. It must be what you feel like when you present I don't know, CPS style cases to me, because you're like, oh. Usually you're like, I'm gonna think about this, and then I'm gonna think about this. Today you're
I be
like
honest with you? I'm even confusing myself. I'm like speaking, I'm like, because I'm not pausing to think of what I'm saying. So someone should really fact check me. It's probably like 20% accurate.
Profrise, let's play a fun game, okay?
Yes.
I want you to engage in reflexes, okay? Reflex.
Yes.
What causes an acute non-GAP acidosis? Reflex. Don't think too much.
Okay.
In general. In general.
An acute non-GAP
Yes.
acidosis.
Acute non-GAP, not chronic.
Yes. Yes, and I'm going to do a reflex. I would say diarrhea.
Yeah, beautiful. Okay, awesome. What causes an acidosis in a patient with alcohol use disorder?
Reflex. Reflex is going to be it's going to be anion gap. It's going to be
Yeah.
ketones and lactate.
Beautiful. All right. Now watch this. She didn't have diarrhea. I went back and confirmed her. And because of my reflexes, which are not logical, I order a lactate and ketones. Her lactate is normal. Her beta hydroxybutyrate is 4, which is ex for maybe adjusting for other non-US units, is extremely high. I'll stop there.
Wow. Okay. So
That's
that's
so
new.
cool, progress.
So I think that it's really, really good because so what you've just shown us
Yeah.
is that there is ketosis. And what you've just shown us is that this patient should have an anion Now the question becomes, it's all, okay. This is my reflex. Okay, either there's and I, and you know what I'm using here analogically. When we have someone with hyponatremia and someone sends a serum osmosis and it's normal, and we're like, oh my gosh, we're in that isoosmolar hyponatremia. Is it a lipid? Is it a paraprotein? Is it something X? But in reality, the most more likely scenario is that it's hyperosmolar plus hypoosmolar got you to isoosmolar. So hypovolemia plus renal insufficiency, BUN, got you to. So here I'm like thinking like one of two possible. Was the gap originally low? And this patient's normal gap isn't really normal, but it's elevated because of the ketones. Or is there some kind of scenario where the patient does have an anion gap acidosis, but also something is driving that lower? That's like where my mind is going, but I haven't actually been in that space before. But I can tell you this confidently. The way we get to ketosis is the anion gap is our clue for that. But I don't care if there's an anion gap or not. If you tell me there's ketones, there should never be ketones. So I can tell you right away this patient is certainly in ketosis. And something about alcoholic ketosis, you don't get less than 14. Like you don't usually you don't get less than 18 with alcohol-induced ketosis. And so the 14 is still within that range. So this would just make me think, is there two processes or is something blocking me from being able to detect there's an anion gap? But I know that for sure there's ketosis, and that's much more likely than a renal tubular acidosis. So enlighten us, educate us.
Dude, so many hours of reading, but you have to stay practical, which is what you said. The problem becomes ketosis. Who cares? I'm glad I stumbled my way there, without elegance in the moment. And then this happened a week ago, and now I literally have probably read like 3 hours about this topic. And so here's what I'll
By the way, when you say this and you say there's an article, our listeners, they keep us honest. We got a
I
comment
haven't said there's
by
an article.
Caitlin saying, where is
Don't
this? So then I have to look into it and find the article and then post it on the
worry. I'm
website.
going to share an updated schema though, because yeah, there's going to be an updated schema of this episode because I learned a lot from this case. So, Professor, let's just stay practical and first have to prove that this is actually our problem. So, for the sake of time, I'll tell you, I treated her ketosis. We should delve into how we do that in general, but it fixed the problem. Her beta-hydroxybutyrate went away, and her bicarb normalized. Okay, so we've proven that, like, the ketosis, as you said, is the issue, right? So, what did I learn? Two things. The first is it came out in your conversation, but it's really helpful to think about a normal gap acidosis, Uncle Bob, into a loss of bicarb or gain of chloride. Now, loss of bicarb is by far and away the most common mechanism because we lose bicarb through diarrhea, or we lose bicarb through the kidney's inability to buffer acid. Okay. And so that's where diarrhea comes into play. That's where chronic kidney disease comes to play. And that's where renal tubular acidosis comes to play, a loss of bicarb. Only after you went through your loss of bicarb schema, Prof, did you start to think, well, wait, is there an increase in chloride from normal saline administration? Because usually you have that information for free. So in this case, there is no loss of bicarb, primarily because the only form of acute non-GAP acidosis, which we know occurs, is not chronic, it's acute based on her priors. It's acute. The only form of loss of bicarb is diarrhea. And so all the other forms of acute non-GAP acidosis are by dumping chloride, like normal saline. But here's the beauty of what happens in patients with ketosis and in patients with certain other negatively charged molecules, which I will list at the end. Is they actually get a gain in chloride from a very cool renal mechanism. What do the kidneys do with ketosis? They actually excrete ketones and exchange that negatively charged ketone for chloride. So, what is happening at the level of the kidney in all patients with ketosis is a switch of ketone for chloride. So, when a patient is developing a ketosis, and their kidneys are healthy and can excrete that ketones, they will develop a non-GAP acidosis. Why do we not see this? The very processes that result in ketosis almost always, near universally, are accompanied by loss of kidney function. Be it
Wow.
hyperglycemia, be it starvation, be it alcohol. The only times you will see a non-GAP acidosis, sorry, an anion gap acidosis with normal kidney function is when somebody gets hyperacute ketoacidosis before the kidneys are able to compensate, and those are the patients who get sudden decay. So the simple version of the story is there is a protective mechanism against an anion gap acidosis, and that's the kidney. And the kidney is there to turn those ketones and switch them to chloride to get excrete that toxic molecule. When does the kidney not do its job? Actually, very commonly, the kidney is not allowed to do its job because it's impaired acutely by the same reason, or the process develops too quickly for the kidney to compensate. And this 2-minute spiel is based on too much reading. But there are other molecules that does this, Profrez. So when patients ingest toluene, a toxic metabolite, patients get first a non-GAP acidosis, and only after the kidneys get impaired do they start to accumulate toluene. So this mechanism was actually first described in the toxic ingestion of toluene. It's also described in patients who get D-lactic acidosis from gut issues, not L. L-lactate is cleared by the liver. D-lactate is cleared by the kidney. So it's a really, really cool illustration. And so what was interesting about this patient is she was a very, very, very focused on hydration. She had this like, I'm sick, and she was drinking a lot. And she was one of those very few water. She's one of those very few patients who I met with ketoacidosis who maintained her volume status. And I think that's why she was different than almost every other patient with alcoholic ketosis I've taken care of, is they usually get nauseous, they vomit. She had this like drive and concern that she was going to get dehydrated, and she maybe even overcompensated by hydrating a lot. And I think that's why she's different than everybody else I've cared for in my career. And that's that, Buffer.
Dude, I have goosebumps right now. That is so cool. So Robbie, Tiago taught me this. He said that Reza, when we all go to sleep at night and we don't eat, we all develop some ketosis. But because the kidney's healthy, we excrete that and we never develop an anion gap. So you in your reading, you said when the kidney excretes the ketone, it retains a chloride in that process. Is that correct? It's so interesting, man, because probably the clueless provider would just be like, oh, bicarb is low alcohol, just ketosis. But the fact that you went down this rabbit hole and have like clarified the pathophysiology, that excites me so much. It's almost like you can't become hyperkalemic unless you have renal insufficiency. Like similarly speak, unless there's a huge disturbance that just overwhelms kidney's ability to excrete. But dude, this is really freaking cool, man. So cool, dude. Wow, thanks for presenting it.
My advice to you all, if you're in training or your journey, there's a lot of things you can learn from this case, but I think one hidden piece of learning is just trying to see boring cases. And I put boring quotes because I don't find any case boring, honestly. I used to, and I used to be like, oh, alcohol, yet another alcohol, yet another alcohol. It's the patient, the hundreds of patients I've seen with alcohol withdrawal who made the learning in this case possible, because one, they help me develop these reflexes of getting the lactate and getting the beta hydroxybutyrate, just reflex without even thinking. And then they also help me see how different this case is than the last 100 people. If I don't see out the regular cases and I don't build a denominator of what I expect, that these unique patterns never will emerge. And I will think, oh, maybe this happens commonly in patients with alcohol use disorder. I've seen at least 100 patients with alcohol use disorder, and this is the first time I've seen it.
I mean, it's the first time I'm ever hearing about it. But honestly, two quick things. One is like, this is the difficulty of medicine. If you just blame the alcohol, you're like, wait, why did you just blame it? There's something else. But if you don't blame the alcohol, you're like, hey, why didn't you just blame the alcohol? That's the most like, make the common thing fit into the uncommon. Then medicine is tough. I don't have an answer for that. But the thing that you said, I never found the case boring. What does that make you think of? The last time you
I've
said
never been burned out.
I never. Should we save that story for next time? Because I know you're.
100%.
That's such a good story.
The prelude is Reza and I getting pelted with rocks and stones because I said, and maybe Reza contributed a little, that I've never been burnt out in my entire life.
This is so good. They just like the 1 second spiel is that we were paid like $4,000. I'm just gonna say the number to give a talk to burned out clinicians, saying that the way you combat burnout is by just reading CPSs. And that the one woman was like folding her kids' clothes, and like she's like, "You're telling me to just," and they were like attacking us. And then Rob is like, "I'll be honest with you guys, to this burned out group of clinicians, I haven't been burned out a day in my life." When he said that, I just started crying from laughter.
Oh my gosh, Buffers. Yeah, good times. I can't believe we still got paid. We've never been paid even close to that amount of money for any lecture we've ever given. And yeah, our performance was an F at best. Oh my gosh. Before you go, Profres, check this out. Maybe you can describe to the audience what you see.
Oh my gosh, like, yeah, how can you leave him?
I
No,
know.
sleeping, so
He's in a
beautiful,
coma.
man.
He's so bored.
Doo-doo-doo.
That's a wrap, folks.
Woo!